This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Affirm Films and the Kendrick Brothers movie Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shire, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters August 23rd. More information is available at overcomermovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Welcome, everybody. Great to have you with us again. The Parliament of the World's Religions bills itself as working for a more just, peaceful, and sustainable world in which religious and spiritual communities live in harmony, a world in which the earth and all life are cherished, protected, healed, and restored, and one in which all people commit to living out their highest values and aspirations. It all sounds so high-minded, but there is a lot more to the Parliament than meets the eye, which my next guest has experienced by attending it. Not only does the Parliament signal the dawning of a new pagan age, but the paganism is not remaining at Stonehenge, and it certainly isn't remaining in the realm of religion per se. In fact, it's safe to say that events like the Parliament are actually helping to set both the tone and the language of the progressive left. We're going to explore that today with Carl Teichrib, editor of Forcing Change, which documents the major social, religious, political, economic, and geostrategic trends impacting our world, and he's also the author of Game of Gods. Carl, great to welcome you back. How are you today?
Hey, I'm doing good, Janet. It's good to be back on the program and talking about these critical issues.
Well, I know we have talked before, as many people will remember, about the Parliament of the World's Religions, and this is a follow-up because of something you said recently. You brought up the fact that as we are seeing political discourse rising surrounding a lot of these current events and the word supremacy being thrown around, that in fact you heard that same kind of talk at the Parliament, which I found very interesting, and I wanted to ask you, what went on and what kinds of connections do you make between supremacy talk at the Parliament and the supremacy talk that we're seeing in some of these leftist political discourses?
Well, it's important to recognize that the Parliament has historically set the tone for the interfaith movement, and the Parliament really acts as a vanguard for progressive leftism. It sets the tone, it helps set the language, it helps set the agenda, because it is a gathering, the Parliament is a gathering of 8,000 to 10,000, depending on the year it's held, religious activists, social change agents, religious leaders, faith and spiritual teachers. And when they leave the Parliament, the ideas, the concepts, the agendas end up going into the cracks and pores of their denomination, into their own different religious faiths, and it spreads out within their own congregation. It is also, the Parliament is, in many respects, it likes to kind of bill itself almost as the visionary, the moral and spiritual visionary of the international community. And it has a lot of work with the United Nations. So it brings this air of legitimacy into the discourse of the progressive left. That's all. All that said, Janet, because when I was at the 2018 Parliament, over and over again, we were told there was no room for exclusivist religions. It was time to end separating faiths. Exclusive truths are taboo. The uniqueness of Jesus Christ is divisive, and we heard that in different ways. Then we were also told endlessly that nationalism and patriotism is the greatest threat. It's an evil scourge that must be overcome. What we need is a new progressive internationalism. Free market capitalism is immoral and unjust. Now, keep in mind, too, Janet, that this was right during the U.S. midterm elections. And so Jim Wallace of Sojourners got up and described that what the midterms were all about was a battle between the angels and the demons. And he was very clear that if you supported Trump, you had sold your soul, and you basically are supporting demons. So throughout the event, we were told, in essence, that religious supremacy, national supremacy, the words white supremacy and white populism was used repeatedly. You are Nazis. Now, here's the kicker. It doesn't matter what your skin color is. This is not about that. This is about an ideology. This is about their view of anybody who holds to nationalism, a religious exclusive truth claim, free market capitalism, all of these, let's call them institutions that have progressed, you know, have been part of the history of the Judeo-Christian Western world. All of that is wrong. And what we need now is a new internationalism, a new progressivism. We need tolerance, Janet. We need love. And if you disagree with their vision, you're not loving. Indeed, you are the enemy.
Goodness. Well, it seems like there's a lot of words that are out there that don't mean exactly what they're saying that they mean. And by this, this is what I mean when I say that. When they're talking about nationalism, when they're talking about capitalism or free markets and things like that, Trump and all the rest, on the one hand, they don't like any of those things. But it seems there's an overarching hatred that they have, and that's toward Christianity, period. Because were it not for the Bible, there wouldn't be a concept of nations and borders. Were it not for the Bible, we wouldn't understand the moral uprightness of private property. Without the Bible, you wouldn't have the Bible is the foundation for our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence. So in other words, it seems like all of these terms that are thrown around with which they would vehemently disagree, fundamentally, it's about Christianity. Would that be a fair assessment in your view?
In my view, it is. And I'm going to say yes to this because on a number of occasions, and specifically towards the closing of the parliament, it was made very clear to us that what we were doing there was engaging in an act of salvation, that we were committed now to saving the earth. And by saving the earth, we save ourselves. And for the longest time, Janet, I'd wrestled. I've been doing this kind of research work for a long time, but I still wrestle with some aspects of it. And I was wrestling with, why is the progressive left so angry, and I mean so openly angry, with those who hold the exclusive truth claims of Christianity? Why? What's going on? Mm. But what I really saw at the parliament was, oh, they have a vision of salvation, and it demands that everybody come on board, because their salvation is about oneness. Their salvation is about all becoming a part of the all. Whereas Christianity offers a different plan of salvation that says, no, the group, the all, doesn't save itself. Christ alone saves. So for the Christian, we can look back and we go, well, you know, this is just all a bunch of crazy stuff. You know, these are just angry individuals. On the flip side, they're looking at us and going, you're a stumbling block to our salvation.
Right. We're in the way, right? We're in the way. We're keeping them from their global oneness. And if we were just out of the way to some extent, then they could achieve it. Is that the corollary to what they're saying?
Yes, absolutely. It is an issue of salvation. They do have a version of salvation. And when I'm saying they, I am referring to the parliament, but beyond the parliament, the whole idea of a progressive, international, collective idea, it is the idea of creation saving itself. And so there is this correlation where now the biblical model of Jesus Christ being the Savior, that exclusivity doesn't fit this model.
Well, no, and I noted in I want to talk a little bit more about one particular chapter in your book, Game of Gods, but you had a quote here from the executive director of United Religions Initiative at the parliament who said, there is no place for exclusivism in religion or in our politics or in our world. Now, that sounds like the stuff of Hitler Rising.
Well, it is revolutionary. In fact, at the parliament last year, the discussion was, what we need to do is engage in global revolution. And to the point of them even saying, what we need is to act in ways that are even subversive, if that was necessary. Senator Douglas Roche, a Canadian senator, said something to the effect of, we have to resist those who would be against us. I'm disturbed by this because the language gets ramped up, and it gets ramped up, and it becomes more... it's more towards that tipping point of a type of grittiness that just, you know, this is going down a bad, bad path. You know, at one time, we would be called a fundamentalist. Okay, you know, I can live with that. We can argue and debate that. There's room for discussion. And then we were called extremists. And you know, going, okay, well, this is getting a little bit harder now to engage in any kind of discourse. But okay, all right, we work with that. The language that came out of the parliament was, now we are all supremacists.
Carl, hang it right there. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with Carl Tykrib. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. We'll pick up the conversation right after this. Janet Mefford Today is proud to partner with Preborn to help save babies' lives.
Well, my name is Dan Steiner, and I'm the president of Preborn. Ultrasound truly is a game changer. When a mom comes into a pregnancy center under pressure to abort her child, perhaps the dad's gone, perhaps her mother is pressuring her. Most of the time in her heart, she doesn't want to abort, but what she needs is something that will give her the strength to choose life against the pressures that are forcing her to consider abortion. That's the ultrasound. If she hears her baby's heartbeat and sees that baby on ultrasound, everything's different.
Will you join us in saving babies' lives? Preborn funds pregnancy centers across the nation so they can offer free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. Ultrasound is a game changer because when abortion-minded women actually see their babies in their wombs for themselves, 80% of the time, they choose life. Would you please join us at Janet Mefford Today to support the ministry of Preborn? For $140, you can provide 5 free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. A gift of $22 will provide 1 ultrasound, and every gift helps. To donate, please call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your gift goes directly towards saving babies. You can get involved, and you can help save a life for a gift of $140. 5 free ultrasounds will be offered to women in crisis pregnancies. Let's do more than talk about abortion. Let's save some lives. Please call now with your gift, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. We're back on Janet Mefford Today. Did you know you're a supremacist if you're a Bible-believing Christian? Have you heard that word supremacist thrown around a lot? It's not just in political discourse. In fact, my guest, Carl Tykrib, author of Game of Gods, is pointing out that when he was at the Parliament of the World's Religions just recently, there was a lot of talk about supremacy, and they were talking about it in a much more scary context than we hear the progressive left necessarily discuss it politically in our own day. Carl, you were saying something very disturbing, but I think this is something every Christian needs to understand. At the Parliament of the World's Religions, as you, I think, brilliantly put it, they used to call us fundamentalists. Now they're calling us supremacists. But the question is, over what are we trying to be supremacists? I'm not really sure how that word even works, other than to be a kind of a vague insult that makes us look bad.
Well, it's a vague insult, but it's more than just that. It leaves a very unsettling feeling in the public light, and I think that's more or less the point of it, is to use language like that, which in essence beats down anybody who would say, "Hold on, I disagree with you, but I'm not a supremacist."
Right.
Nobody likes to be called that. We recognize where that language takes us. But by painting us with that language, it is a very powerful tool, is a very powerful public tool to silence us.
Right.
One of the workshops, I wasn't able to attend it. I attended a different workshop when there was a workshop being held on bringing the evangelicals on board. However, I had some friends who did attend that, and I've got the audio from it, the slides from that particular workshop. The recognition in one of the workshops there was that the evangelical community is really the the dominant roadblock to their outcome, and that they need to strategize ways of bringing the evangelical community on board to accept the interfaith agenda because, well, hey, we are a very large population, and we're one of the groups that's not at the table. Everybody else is at the table, but we're not at the table. And so how do we bring the evangelical community in? Well, to use the words like supremacist, I don't think that actually wins them over.
No, to say the least, no.
Right. So what I found interesting was you had a two-prong approach. You had a carrot and stick approach. Yes, you see that language of raw supremacy used in the public discourse now, but at the same time, the workshop that my friends attended were all about to use a softer approach of trying to influence, especially young Christian leaders, and this is important, influence young Christian leaders, influence youth pastors, influence junior clergy, because they're the ones more susceptible to embracing interfaithism if it's attached to doing community projects and community service.
Wow. Well, that sounds like a lot of what's going on in evangelicalism today in the Southern Baptist Convention in particular. You're finding a lot of that now.
You are. That's one of the values for myself as an author and as a researcher going to events like this, because it's one thing to pick up a report and read it, or to pick up a press release and take a look at what the press is saying about an event. It's something else entirely when you're there and you're listening with your own ears and you're hearing the talk in the hallways, the talk that takes place afterwards, and then you realize really quickly, okay, there's some pretty big things going on.
Well, there really are. One of the things you also pointed out, Carl, which I think people need to know about, is that you attended the United Nations, a Catalyst for Interfaith Action. This was, I guess, a workshop that you went to. And at that particular gathering, the idea was religions must be restructured to ensure earth loyalties and earth service, in essence, to create a green new spiritual deal. Now, that's really creepy. What is a green new spiritual deal? Can you explain exactly what that means?
Well, yes, absolutely. Yes, the green new spiritual deal, the bottom line is you have to have your loyalties and allegiance is to the earth. Your allegiance and loyalties is to creation. And now you need to begin to modify your purchasing behavior, your belief system, your values, to reflect those earth-centric, a new Green Deal agenda. And I mean, you know, the Green New Deal, obviously in your country, I'm from Canada, but in your country, there's been a lot of discussion about the Green New Deal.
Right.
It really is a restructuring of your faith. Yes, you can keep your Christianity if it's a progressively understood, internationalist, social justice, evolutionary type of Christianity, one that's going to say the earth is a pathway to salvation and to even our own sense of community and connection. If you don't fit that, you're not going to be a part of the solutions. You're part of the problem. And the idea of this new deal is, yeah, we need to modify your purchasing behaviors. We need to modify your values. And the primary way of doing this is really to go after the children. I've seen this at other events where youth are targeted because they're the ones who carry the emotional energy, and they can bring it back to their parents, they can bring it back to their youth groups, they can bring it back to their schools, and they're the ones who now carry the banner of this new green revolution.
Right. Well, this is kind of interesting because most recently here in the United States, I don't know if you're familiar with the Democratic hopeful Pete Buttigieg. Are you familiar with him?
No, I'm not.
Okay, let me tell you a little bit about Pete Buttigieg. He is trying to become president of the United States on the Democratic ticket. He is a homosexual. He is, quote unquote, married to another man. He's constantly shoving that in everybody's face. He's a mayor of South Bend, Indiana, so he doesn't really have the background where he would be prepared to be president other than his identity politics. But what's interesting about him is from day one, he has talked about how horrible Mike Pence is, our vice president, who is a biblical Christian, and he has put down Pence's faith, and he's talked about how he is homophobic and all that. So he's kind of tried to grab the religious banner for himself, but in a progressive way, because he's an Episcopalian. What was interesting was he just hired this faith outreach director, and listen to the description of the faith outreach director, Carl. This will fit perfectly with what you're talking about. She's a Unitarian Universalist minister who is a bisexual, has a lesbian daughter who founded the first gay pride parade for kids in her town, this rural town in Colorado. She's been a political protester. She's an active progressive. She's been arrested several times. And I'm thinking to myself, what they're really doing on the progressive left, because Cory Booker, another hopeful, is also hiring a faith outreach director. What they are trying to do is hijack religion. And they're trying to tell the American voters, we're more open-minded, but we're just as religious. And in fact, we're better at being religious than those supremacists on the right. Now, would this be in keeping with what you're talking about, that they're taking the language of the Parliament of the World's Religions and they're applying it during the election? We're the religious people. We're the virtuous people over here. When to the naked eye, you say, everything about you is wrong. What are you talking about? But this is an interesting strategy, because I haven't really seen this happen in the same way, quite the same way before.
No, this fits. This fits incredibly well. And it fits because at the Parliament, you are always hearing that what they are engaging in, this act of salvation, this method, this technique of collective salvation, is a morally superior position.
Yes.
It is the moral high ground. And what people need to get, especially for us Christians, we need to get this into our heads, is interfaithism is more than just simply a gathering of various religions. And I've got the sentence in my book on page 413. Interfaithism is more than religious solidarity in light of social change. It is politics wrapped in a veneer of spirituality.
Wow. That's it. That's it. Well, that's the thing. I think what they're really concerned about is that we don't have the morality that draws those dumb redneck evangelicals to the polls to vote for Democrats. We're even seeing this in evangelicalism. You have the ERLC, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, which is, you know, Dr. Russell Moore is the head of that, and he's a communitarian, and he talks a lot about, you know, our obligations, and you shouldn't let politics drive the gospel, but he's a liberal. One of his things lately has been holistic pro-life. We're not just pro-life as to abortion, but we're holistically pro-life. And what that does is guilt evangelicals into saying, well, if I'm not helping Muslim refugees come across the border and welcoming illegal aliens, then I am disobeying scripture. I mean, this is really sneaky and underhanded to try to use the Bible to guilt people to vote for the politician that you want them to vote for.
Yeah, it's progressive spiritual politics. That's what it is. It really becomes a type of a cult of world order. Follow our lead. Follow our redemption plan. We're going to save the world, and we're going to do it through the power of our group, and we're going to do it through the power of our progressive politics, which is group politics. It is always about the collective. That's where it goes. And the language is being ramped up, and what it does is it puts evangelical Christians who don't agree with them, it puts them automatically within a corner, and our backs end up going up against the wall, as now the language of media, the language of our politicians, the language of even faith leaders, as you know this very, very well, all of a sudden gets turned back on us because we're not playing with the group.
Well, that's what's really, really disturbing about it. And people are so susceptible to this, because the minute you tell somebody they're not being biblical, who's a Bible believer, even Christian, the first reaction is, oh no, I'm being unbiblical. Where am I being unbiblical? That's what the real, I would say, you know, deception of the whole thing is, that they're using this kind of language to manipulate people's emotions in order to control them. And you're exactly right, Carl. Where they're headed with this is a collective. It's group politics, as you said. And I want to dive into this a little bit even more deeply when we come back. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Carl Teichgruber and I will be back right after this. Stay with us. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Affirm Films and the Kendrick Brothers movie Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shire, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters August 23rd. More information is available at overcomermovie.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Romans 12:18 says, if possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Now, this is an interesting verse because of that clause, if possible. But yet we Christians are to be peacemakers because we worship the Prince of Peace, who is our peace. Is there a way, though, to have healthy relationships, conflict resolution, and a life of peace based upon biblical principles? We're going to tackle that today with Brian Noble, who serves as the executive pastor of the Valley Assembly of God Church in Spokane, Washington. He is also the executive director of Peacemaker Ministries and is out with a book called The Path of a Peacemaker. Brian, it's great to have you with us. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing fine. Thank you. Well, tell us a little bit, for those people who don't know much about Peacemaker Ministries, what you guys are all about and what you do.
All right. So for the last 30 years, Peacemaker Ministries has helped equip and assist Christians to respond to conflict biblically. In a simple form, we create cultures of peace and productivity.
That's great. That's well said. Yeah. Very, very condensed. I love it. So when you're talking about dealing with conflict in churches, I'm sure that there are all kinds of conflicts that come up. But a lot of people will say, well, how do you know when outside help is needed, that the conflict in your church is to the point where you can't resolve it yourselves?
Well, I like to say call us sooner than later, simply because we're oftentimes called very late in the game. And the reality is we all need times where we can brainstorm with someone else or talk through an idea. And having been a pastor for 20 years, not that I have every idea in the world, but I've seen a lot of situations. And maybe if it's earlier, we can just have simply a brainstorming session with a pastor or a group of elders to try to resolve the conflict. But if you're in major conflict that's going around and around and around, it's very important that you give us a call. Matthew 18 is clear to get outside help, where we can help each other in the body of Christ move forward in the things that God would have and get you back on track for sharing the gospel with people.
Well, again, anybody who's ever been in a church in their lives will know that there is often a lot of conflict at the church level, whether it's little conflict or major conflict. I'm curious to ask you, though, what are some of the most common sorts of conflicts with which you guys deal when churches call you? What are some of the most common things that are the source of conflict?
I would say the primary conflict would be between elders and their pastor. Oftentimes there's different expectations, especially where maybe an elder or a board, whatever title that they may use within the local congregation, especially when a board has been silent for a number of years and maybe didn't say what they truly thought, and then all of a sudden they start saying what they think, and then now there's tension because the pastor has thought that that behavior was acceptable for an extended period of time. And so that's typically what we see in conflict and the type of phone calls we get. There are the rare exceptions where either a child's been hurt or there's been embezzlement or there's been those kind of extreme situations. But a lot of it simply has to do with how does the pastor interact with their board or their elders or deacons, depending on the polity.
Yeah. Is this oftentimes, or is it most often, happening in independent churches that cannot appeal to an outside denominational body?
That is very, very common. So a lot of non-denominational churches don't have, you know, someone to go up to. But I will say that probably 60% of our casework is with that type of organization. The other 40% is with those who are part of a denomination. And sometimes the denomination has called us and said, we simply want someone who's neutral, who has some outside insight that can come in and help us understand the culture that has been created, help us understand how to transform that culture into something new and thrive in again. And so, you know, we do see it on both sides, but oftentimes it is when you know, a local congregation has no one to appeal to make the final decision.
Right. They just want peace. They just want it all resolved. And you,
exactly.
Yeah. You talk in your book about a path to a lifestyle of peace, and you talk about these different steps. I want to talk about this step of tension. That's where it all begins. Yeah. But you actually have also said it can work for you. Tension isn't always a bad thing. Can you outline what you're talking about there when you are talking about tension and where the path to peace begins?
Absolutely. Oftentimes when in churches, we have spiritualized a lack of tension, and yet our Bibles are filled with stories where God uses tension to bring about better character, to bring about a better circumstance, people who honor him. So, for instance, in James chapter 1, it says, consider it all joy, my brother, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And then it says this, let endurance have its perfect result. So peacemakers like to say this, healthy tension brings us closer together, and unhealthy tension pulls us apart. And so God uses those tensions. Every good and perfect gift comes from God. And he uses those tensions in life to form within us the character that he needs to move us forward. And so many of our organizations, our churches that we have, you know, they don't allow healthy tension or healthy dialogue, as Paul would say, speaking the truth in love. And so they kind of get plateaued. And what we need to do is begin to embrace the healthy stuff and negate the unhealthy stuff.
Yeah. Now, it sounds great. I'm a little unclear, though. What is healthy tension? How do I put tension in the healthy category? Explain what that is about.
So healthy tension is like iron sharpening iron, right? So yes. One person sharpens another. Healthy tension is clear communication, but it's filled with the gospel. So sometimes as Christians, because we want to be nice, to our pastor's face, we'll say, et cetera, you know, this is how I feel. But behind their back, we have much more of an articulated viewpoint of whatever took place.
Right.
And so healthy tension is living authentically, but with compassion. And it brings us closer together. We like to use the illustration of like a Sunday school class that one wants to go through Romans, another one wants to go through John. And really, they're both great books in the Bible. But we need to have the dialogue of what would serve the people the best. And sometimes we avoid the dialogue, or we create two Sunday school classes, or we divide the church or what have you. Even though that may not be a bad option, if two classes may not be a bad option, but you get what I'm saying. It's avoiding the conversation instead of really coming in and saying, listen, let's dialogue. What do our people need? How can we serve them best and bring them the gospel? I think healthy tension is collaborative. It's like a football team. If you didn't have tension in a football game, it would be a very boring game, right?
Yes.
But what makes it exciting is, you know, we're all headed down the field in the same direction. Someone's calling the plays and the shots as we go. And we're all, as in Romans chapter 12, we're all functioning in the roles that God's given us to move us forward so that the gospel goes out. And so that's what healthy tension is. It's understanding our blind spots. Many of Paul's writings towards the end of his books, he creates tension when he says, so-and-so deserted me. This other person did this, and he creates this tension of moving us forward.
Yeah. Now, this is interesting because when you're touching on the subject of not wanting to address things, I think that's a pretty common thing. At least it is in the churches that I've attended over the years, because we're Christians. We're nice. We don't want to have a fight. We don't want to bring anything up. And yet the tension persists. It's just unspoken. And then it seeps through oftentimes in bad ways. So how much do you see that sort of thing being the main cause of the conflict, that had you dealt with it early on in a straightforward way, it probably would not have risen to this insane level that it becomes later?
It's exactly right. So what we find in most churches, elders or boards can stay silent for about 4 years.
Oh,
some are really good. They can stay silent for like 10 years, but most of the time it's 4 years and then they rise up and say their opinion. Well, what's happened is I've had so many pastors tell me this. They never told me that it was a problem.
Wow.
Like my leadership was a problem. They never told me that when I did this, that drove everyone nuts, you know, and I believe them because I've done this. We do these assessments, right?
Right.
And on the assessment, the board member would say, no, I never said anything. But now they want to call for their resignation over something they never spoke about to them about. I mean, I'm not trying to make it simplified, but it's kind of insane. You know, it's like, really, like if you would have addressed it the first time it happened, you know, Pastor, when you get up, get done preaching and you immediately leave the church, it says to us that maybe that you don't care about us, right?
Yes.
And we would really appreciate it if you would mingle with the people.
Yeah.
But instead, they let it go on for 4 years or 5 years. And then they're like, well, he doesn't have a pastor's heart.
Oh, well, my goodness.
I can give you other examples, like that. But
yeah. Brian,
it's
crazy. Brian, hang on a moment. We do need to pause for a quick break. We'll come back with Brian Noble. The Path of a Peacemaker is his book. We'll return right after this on Janet Mefford Today.
Hi, this is Kirk Cameron, and I am honored to be partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to help moms choose life.
Actor Kirk Cameron supports Preborn.
My four oldest children were adopted. That is because of caring and compassionate people who help those young mothers choose life. My wife is an adopted child, and her birth mother chose life for her. If it weren't for those caring individuals that help those young moms value the sacredness of life, I wouldn't have my wife, I wouldn't have my four adopted children, and the two natural born children that we have wouldn't exist either. My whole family is here because of people that are involved with ministries like Preborn.
Preborn funds pregnancy centers across the nation so they can offer free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. Ultrasound is a game changer because when abortion-minded women actually see their babies in their wombs for themselves, 80% of the time, they choose life. Would you please join us at Janet Mefford today to support the Ministry of Preborn? For $140, you can provide 5 free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. A gift of $22 will provide 1 ultrasound, and every gift helps. To donate, please call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your gift goes directly towards saving babies. You can get involved, and you can help save a life for a gift of $140. 5 free ultrasounds will be offered to women in crisis pregnancies. Please call now with your gift, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY, 855-402-2229, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. This hour, Janet Mefford Today, brought to you by Affirm Films and the Kendrick Brothers movie Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shire. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested in theaters August 23rd. More information is available at overcomermovie.com. Well, my guest is Carl Tykrib from Forcing Change. He has a great book out, Game of Gods, The Temple of Man in the Age of Reenchantment. We're talking a little bit about what went on at the Parliament of the World's Religions. As I mentioned before, Carl, we have done a previous interview on the last Parliament, but I wanted to bring you back because you were talking about how the language of the Parliament, of Christians being supremacists and that sort of language, is really seeping into the progressive political discourse as we're heading into another presidential election season in the United States. One other thing, though, I wanted to be sure to get to before we have to let you go is the fact that another thing you bring up in the Game of Gods is that you have attended this gathering called Paganicon. Is that how you pronounce it? Of pagans, witches, Wiccans. And I guess you've done this a few times, right? This was just a few months ago.
Yes, correct. I was there in March of this year at Paganicon. Paganicon is the convention for the nation of Paganistan. And Paganistan is the Twin Cities, western Wisconsin. You could include sections of western Wisconsin and basically that region that is super saturated with a very large pagan presence, large enough that they have, this year was their ninth annual convention of Paganistan.
Boy, I'll tell you why this is important. When we're talking about oneness and this global, you know, emphasis on oneness and Mother Earth and Gaia and the resurgence of paganism, ancient paganism, the age of reenchantment that you write about in the book, one of the things that stood out for me in this most recent article you wrote about this gathering was that there was a broad acceptance of Satanism. Can you talk about that and tell people why that's important for them to know about?
Oh, yeah. You know, this is really interesting. So many Christians immediately view witches and Wiccans and Satanists all being the same. They're not. Satanism is a very distinct branch. We use it generically or in a large context, but in the pagan world, it's a very specific branch of religion. Now, this was the first time that Satanism was brought in specifically to in essence, be viewed as an equal or as a partner within the pagan community. And so there was a number of workshops at Paganistan this year where Satanism was discussed. We had a workshop. I went to one specifically called Satanism 101, and it was fascinating as I listened to even pagans, Wiccans, say to the Satanist, we actually owe you guys an apology because we, in the past, have not embraced Satanism or the left-hand path, Luciferianism, as having equal validity to what our paths are.
Oh, man.
So, you know, it was really, really interesting. What, now, here's the thing that, like, I mean, I go to these events because this is what I do. I'm a researcher. That's my forte.
Yeah.
I don't recommend everybody go and run off to events like this, not by any stretch of the imagination. But what I found disturbing, especially disturbing, listening as the pagans and the Satanists were talking, was, and this was right before one of the workshops, because, you know, this is just banter, just chatter. But what blew me away was when they were talking about how Christians have responded to them. And Christians have responded, and as they were describing it, by calling them some of the most vile things that could be imagined. They talked about how Christians would call them down and debase them. And the Satanists even said, hey, you know, I had one instance where a Christian walked across the parking lot and got a bag of trash and threw the garbage on me. Janet, that made my blood boil. That made my blood boil because we are supposed to be different. We are supposed to follow the first, you know, we have two commandments that everything falls into: to love the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, and soul, and then to love our neighbors as ourselves.
Yes,
and that includes loving people, even if their worldview is in direct conflict with our worldview. Let's call out what things are, but at the same time, let us also be loving. We need to embrace both truth and grace. And that really bugged me. It really bugged me a lot hearing that, because it was like, okay, this is not being salt and light in the world then.
Right. And even though when you hear stories like that, A, you wonder how much of it is actually true, or B, if that person really was a Christian, or if that was just somebody who walked out of a Methodist church or something and dumped garbage. But it doesn't matter, because if the person regarded that person as a Christian, then that is important for us to act, like you said, with great love for our neighbor, because that's what the Lord would have us do. What I was interested about in your account, Carl, was the fact that when you have a more embracing, I would say, you know, thrust now within the pagan community of accepting Satanism, this is very troubling when you look at the bigger picture of we're all one, we're all a religion of nature, and you see that important distinction between creator and creation in the Bible. How does this come together for you from a macro perspective of playing out in the next few years? I mean, how close are we to really being rounded up? I mean, that sounds terrible. I hope and pray that never, ever happens. But it is a logical question for a lot of Christians. At what point are they going to come get us or do something to try to get us in line at least?
You know, that's a fair question. It's fair because historically, you know, the Christian community, we've experienced persecution in different parts of the world, and there are a lot of parts of the world experiencing it right now. It doesn't have to come together in let's say how do I describe this? It doesn't have to come together in a way where we see a global government in place. I believe that's coming. In fact, I've seen enough documentation and literally have rubbed shoulders in that community well enough to know. Anybody who reads my book, Game of Gods, understands where I've been that way. But persecution comes all over the place, and it happens all over the world. And I think it's important as Christians that we understand that it can come right into your workplace, right into your home, right into your school. Being in America, or for me, being in Canada, is no safeguard. We need to understand that as the world hates us because of Christ, that there will be times of trouble. There will be times of persecution. And we have to get our head wrapped around that. At the same time, here's the dichotomy I've seen with Christians and with even myself. To act in a way that is loving and graceful with truth, and yet without fear.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah, that's absolutely key. And what about going back to the narrative that you saw coming out of the parliament that is showing up now among the progressive leftists who are calling Christians supremacists? How do we counter that stuff when we're being told we're supremacists and we're left scratching our heads and saying, I don't want to be supreme? You know, he who is the least is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. I mean, that's far from the Christian ethos, is wanting to be supreme. How do we defend ourselves with that kind of talk going around?
One of the things we really have to watch out for is how talk like that ends up becoming instituted within hate crime laws, within public policy and public discussion, and where we have the opportunity to vocalize our concerns, we need to take those opportunities. Oftentimes we're silent, and that silence enables and allows that type of language to continue. And so there has to be a certain amount of pushback, but really watch where it comes in terms of hate crime legislation or the discussion of hate crime legislation. And I know right now in Canada, we're moving into our election phase this fall, and already the language of supremacy is coming up over and over again. It's being targeted. It's being used in a very specific way. And you're going, okay, you guys, quit with this. Quit. Let's enter an honest discourse. Quit with that, because there's nothing honest about it.
Well, there's nothing honest about it, but they don't really care. As long as it works, as long as the political goal is reached by using that language, then the ends justify the means, I suppose, for some of these folks.
Sure. Of course, then the danger also comes in the fact that they themselves may end up becoming broadly brushed with something as well. I mean, it ends up becoming a tit-for-tat kind of a thing, and that's the danger. You know, and my goodness, the last number of years, and you can say this going back to the last number of decades, we've been able to watch the Western world slowly, slowly rip each other apart. And it's only becoming more and more vitriolic.
Yeah, vitriolic and chaotic. But when you're vitriolic and chaotic, you can take advantage of that for political gain. That's what we really have to watch out for. And thankfully, I don't know how it is in Canada, but thankfully in the United States, there are millions of Christians in particular who understand that. And that was why they voted the way they did in the last election, because they knew what the flip side would be if they didn't act and if they didn't stand up. Maybe, just maybe, out of all of this, there will be some awakening within the Christian community as to what we need to do, not just heading into the next election, but just understanding the times in which we live. That's what the Bible warns us about, that we need to be on the alert because our enemy prowls around seeking someone to devour. We need to put our focus on the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, The Game of God's book, wonderful, by Carl Tykrib. Pick it up. And Carl, always wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us and for all the great work that you do in forming the church.
Well, thank you, Janet. God's still on the throne, and we can take assurance in that. Thanks for allowing me to be on your program today.
Always great to talk to you, Carl. God bless you, and a good reminder, Jesus is Lord. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on Janet Meffer Today.